Hello and welcome to The Energy Gang, a discussion show about the fast-changing world of energy. I'm Ed Crooks, and we've got a really very exciting show for you today, because it is my great pleasure to welcome back to the show, after an absence of many years, Jigar Shah. Of course, famously a founder of this podcast, one of his greatest achievements, huge figure in the world of energy generally, and currently the director of the Loan Programs Office at the Department of Energy. Hi, Jigar, how are you? Welcome back.
Oh my gosh, it's great to be back. Thanks for all the great work you're doing.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It's been too long, certainly. It's great to see you back here again. I should also, before we get properly started, congratulate you. You've named by Time Magazine one of the 100 most influential people of 2024. That's very impressive.
You know, it is. You know, the weird thing for me is the fact that our sector and the work that we do made that list, right? I mean, you know, it's one thing to be a big fish in a small pond. It's another thing for our sector to even be recognized within that list, which I think is a big testament to where we are right now.
Yeah, and not unreasonable. I think I always say to people, kind of half joking, we have the most important job in the world, but kind of is the most important job in the world, right? I mean, providing the energy that people need while also not destroying the ecosystem that enables modern civilization to exist. That's hard to think of things that are more important than that.
And LPO, I mean, Jigar, we really admire your going to LPO in the first place. I mean, when you look at the success from 2009, you know, during the era, stimulus, you know, it really proved out in the United States you could make money doing utility scale solar.
No, I think you're absolutely right.
Right. And that was, I mean, that's helping us today decarbonize. So, you know, we're really interested to hear, like, what do you think the successes are going to be going forward? Because the LPO office, absolutely, time should be recognizing what you're doing. So, you know, great to hear now from you, you know, where you think it is.
And I should introduce you, Amy.
Right.
Exactly.
I'm talking without being introduced.
Feel free. No problem at all. Amy Myers Jaffe is, of course, the director of the Energy, Climate Justice and Sustainability Lab at New York University. And also, Amy, welcome to the program. So we've just been talking about the LPO. Let's think a little bit about that. And it'd be interesting to hear from you, Jigar, a bit about what you're trying to achieve and how successful you think you've been at it. You've been at the office now a little over 3 years. And I was looking back at your appointment, and I see that Jennifer Granholm, the Energy Secretary, said at the time that your job was to wake up the LPO. I think certainly by some metrics, you've been successful in that. Looking at some of the numbers, at the end of 2021, you had about $60 billion of currently active applications for support open. In March of this year, that was up to about $262 billion. So that's, what is that, more than fourfold increase in less than 3 years. So certainly kind of interest in the LPO seems a lot higher. And apparently you're getting almost an average of new applications for support coming in every week. How do you feel it's been going? Have you achieved the things you've wanted to achieve?
Yeah, it's a good question, right? I think when you think about, you know, the president's agenda of passing the IRA and bill and the secretary's agenda, which has been to expand the Department of Energy to beyond just research and development, but also now taking, you know, real responsibility around commercialization. I think that the details have to be filled out. Right. I mean, it's one thing to sort of say we're going to do industrial strategy. And she gave an extraordinary speech at the National Press Club recently. But it's another thing for the private sector to go, oh, we're supposed to be partners with the public sector now. Like, this is not where the public sector gives you these passive tax credits and you're sort of off to the races. Now there's, you know, the implementation of the tax policy. There's, you know, figuring out how the Department of Commerce and some of our trade stuff works.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Actually, I hadn't thought about it that way. But as you say, you get that fantastic overview of the landscape. How are you finding it working in government? This is your first full-time government job, right?
You've been It is.
Various jobs in the private sector, and you've done kind of advisory roles for the government before. Never full-time, though.
It is. You know, it's a funny thing, right? Because people constantly say, well, you know, the government must be bureaucratic and all these rules and all this other stuff. But honestly, the private sector is no different, right? If I had to write a billion-dollar check from Generate Capital, right, there are a lot of people to check with, right? Even when you're a GP and you've got LPs and you're saying, well, you know, we already have your money. You don't need to check with you. You kind of have to check with them, because if you don't, then the next time you go fundraise, they're not going to give you money, right? And so when you think about all of the processes and procedures that I have to go through at the loan programs office, it's actually very similar. Obviously, they're solving for slightly different things, but very similar to the private sector, where you really have to maintain good relationships, make sure you're asking a couple times, giving people a chance to, you know, sit with an idea before you come to them for a final decision, right? You know, like, you know, grease the skids as you were, right? And, you know, that's also true for the community benefits plans and labor and all these other pieces is, you know, is this de-risking things? Like, is this going to lead to better community relations? Like, how are we thinking about all these things? And so I don't think of it as much more difficult than the private sector as much as a slightly different rule set than the private sector, but the same level of complexity.
And what about, like, is it easier to do technology evaluation because you're at the government and you have all these technical people at DOE, or you think it's, you know, just as challenging to decide what really could lend itself to commerciality if you were sitting in a VC firm or yourself had your own firm and you were making investments?
Yeah, it's a great question. And one that I think goes to the heart of, you know, the challenges of our past, right? In general, I would say the political nature, you know, of these things, nobody wants us to take will it work or won't it work risk, right? So we can't take technology risk that is, we're not sure it's going to work, but we're going to give it a good try, right? That's really in other parts of DOE where they do demonstration projects and grant projects, et cetera. For our stuff, we have to establish that it works. Now, we may have scale-up risk, we might have execution risk, you might have lots of reasons why a company goes bankrupt. But when you think about all of the failures in our past, we really only
got— Or recently with the SPACs. I mean, so many failures in the SPAC system.
Well, for sure. But I would say that where we've gotten beat up is where the underlying technology didn't work. Where the technologies worked, but we had execution or scale-up risk, we actually didn't get beat up out of our office. I think, you know, I think folks sometimes gloss over it, but it's important to look through what, you know, our oversight folks are really solving for. They're saying, look, you're supposed to help the nation's best innovators and entrepreneurs fully commercialize their technology, but you're not supposed to take a flyer on whether something works or doesn't work, right? And I think that is something we can uniquely take care of at the Department of Energy, because most of these original patents were from one of our labs, right? And they actually know what the 12 demonstration projects were and what the lessons learned that came out of each one of them. And so, you know, we're really good at assessing technology risk. I mean, and it makes us uniquely capable of providing these loans in a way that the commercial sector has a hard time with.
And do you think that, I mean, it's enabling, right? So you just said what you said. Now I'm a commercial partner. I feel more comfortable that you've looked at it and you decide it's a worthwhile program, right?
Well, so I think that that's absolutely the thesis. And I agree that that's true. But we're not taking it for granted. So, you know, now we're on basically a roadshow talking about our track record, right, and how well we've done for both corporate investors as well as project investors, and actually explaining that in great detail to, you know, probably close to 50 to 75 funds who are often equity investors in our projects, right, so that they understand the nitty-gritty details, right? So I agree with you that I think people are giving us the benefit of the doubt, but I think it's important for us to go and actually explain ourselves for an hour.
So that's a great introduction to getting in some of the details of some of these technologies that we want to talk about for the rest of this show. Just before we do that, it's probably a good idea to talk about the overall landscape. As you say, Jigar, you're in this fantastic position of being able to see everything that's going on in the world of energy from the vantage point where you sit, and both what's happening in the private sector and the way that the administration's policy relates to that. I wanted to raise an issue we've talked about a lot on this show recently, which is the question of rising demand for power, driven by AI, of course, new manufacturing facilities, electrification of transport, all these things we've been talking about a lot. There's been a lot of excitement about that in recent months, and you're seeing a lot of utilities in particular coming out with integrated resource plans, talking about huge increases in load that they're saying is going to need to be met very often with investment in new gas-fired power plants. What's your take on this general question of growing power demand in the US? Do you think there's something really happening there? Are we now going to be seeing a very significant increase in demand, or is some of it being overhyped?
Well, a lot of it's clearly being overhyped. I mean, there's a lot of people who have an incentive to overhype it. But we clearly have load growth. I mean, I think it's important to start, again, from the fact base, right? Which is, for the last 10 years, we've had 0.4% growth per year, right? So that is the baseline. Now, growth in any shape or form is disruptive, right? You gotta like take what you already have and then add more stuff, right? And adding more stuff is hard, right? And so if you doubled growth from 0.4 to 0.8, that's a lot. If you tripled it, right, to 1.2%, if you quadrupled it to 1.6%, that's still a lot, right? And so like my sense is that we're probably on track to doubling electricity sales by 2050. Right, I think everyone pretty much agrees with that, and that's roughly 2 to 2.5% growth per year. Right now, there's a lot of folks saying we're at 5% growth, or 6% growth, or 7% growth. Right, my sense is that's a little bit hyperbolic, and you know, there's good reasons for people to be hyperbolic. So I'm not like accusing them of anything nefarious. I understand that there's a push and pull between regulators and utilities and all that stuff. But I also think that, you know, one thing that happens is that folks learn how to be more efficient. You saw NVIDIA just come out with their announcement that their next generation chip is 50% less, energy usage. All the data center companies are magically capable of, finding ways to be more efficient. The low case out of BCG has been roughly 200,000 gigawatt hours of growth by 2030. Right. My sense is that is a safe assumption that we all should agree that is probably going to happen. But to put that in comparison, we use 4,200 terawatt hours of electricity in this country. Right. That's 200 terawatt hours. So that's 5% right through 2030. Now we've got new manufacturing facilities because of the extraordinary success from the IRA and bill. And then you have EV charging. Not all load growth is disruptive, though, right? Remember, we have way overpaid for our infrastructure in this country, right? We have a capacity utilization rate that has gone from about 70% capacity utilization rate down to about 40%. So we only use what we've already paid for 40% of the time. And so if you have EV charging and you do what Duke and Florida Power and Light is doing and saying, hey, we'll put this stuff in, but there's 4 hours a day where we're not going to let you charge, right, in order to fit into the existing infrastructure, that's not disruptive at all, right? And then if you've got data centers that are running 24/7, well, then that can be quite disruptive because you're increasing the peak power, right? And then we've got all these tools and all these other things. But I think it's important to level set that it's not the load growth that actually is negatively impacting us. In some ways, it's great, right? Because if the denominator is getting bigger and you increase utilization of existing assets, rates could go down over this period of time, right? What the problem that we have is that the vast majority of the players around the table haven't been in this situation for 20 years. So their entire careers in the electric utility sector, they haven't seen growth. So, and you see that, right? There's a huge amount of turnover. I think 10% of utility CEOs have resigned recently because they're like, I'm out. I don't want to learn new stuff. I'm going to let somebody else come in and figure this out, right? And so that churn is, I think, the part that we're in right now. And I think the fact base that DOE provides is helpful as people start to build up what we want to do during this growth phase.
To your point then about not all load growth is created equal, it is the case, is it not, that a lot of these new loads are inflexible, right? I mean, as you say, you mentioned data centers. People probably want to run their data centers 24/7. If you've got a new chip factory or a battery factory, those are going to run round the clock and ideally maximize utilization. Isn't that the case that actually a lot of what we're seeing now is not going to be flexible?
Well,
and it's not going to be.
Yeah, let's go through the numbers real quick. So if you have 4,200 terawatt hours of sales roughly now, right? And you add 2% a year, right? And you multiply that just in a linear fashion without the exponent, that's 12%, right? So that's somewhere in the neighborhood of 500 terawatt hours of growth. Right. So we established 200 terawatt hours was data centers. Right. So now you've got 300 terawatt hours and they're variable in terms of how much flexibility they have. EV charging is clearly very flexible, but frankly is not going to be a huge growth driver until the next decade. Right. And a lot of it's going to be Bill and IRA manufacturing facilities, but a lot of them don't have to run 24/7 either. A lot of them have said, look, if it's 100 degrees outside, we're happy to shut down for a week so that, you know, we can do retooling in the factory, we can do our maintenance, we can do other stuff, and, you know, not have to pay these exorbitant costs on the Texas grid when, you know, it's 100 degrees outside, right? So I think that there's variable amounts of flexibility built into these loads, and you can spur flexibility via price signals, right? Because the cost of that peak power is very expensive to the grid. Let's call it 30 cents a kilowatt hour, right? So now the question, because it's not just the generation, you have to upgrade the transmission, upgrade the distribution, all of that work, right? And so the question becomes, could you incentivize people to actually shift load? Can you incentivize people to increase grid capacity? Can you incentivize people to be more flexible, right? Some people you can, some people you can't. So that to me is the key to this whole conversation. And you're even seeing the data center folks saying, you know what, if you give me a discount, I'll put in a ton of long duration energy storage batteries at my site and take my load off grid for 8 to 12 hours.
So Jigar, when, you know, let's go down the rabbit hole of that for 1 second, because it does raise this sort of complicated question, which is how we price electricity in the United States. And I've had like a million people explain to me about how wholesale buyers, the way that market works, they are the ones who have to get the discount and so forth. But, you know, there's always this sort of justice concern, which is, you know, there are people in the United States who are at risk of shutoff during a heat wave and can't pay their bill, and they're making compromised decisions about, you know, food versus air conditioning or food versus heat. And so, you know, do you think we need to, you know, as we think about, you know, this transition to, you know, higher load and the problem of peak, you know, it's not just about taking the five people who've already, you know, made the pitch like me to buy an electric car, not charging at a certain time. I mean, you also have just this question of retail prices.
Yeah, energy burden is a huge concern, not only for me, of course, but for the entire Department of Energy and for the Biden administration. And energy burden has gotten far worse, right, over the last 10 years. And so I think when you think about why that is, it's a choice, right? So when you think about the incentives that came out of the IRA, right, we have a whole bunch of money for weatherization and Hope for Homes and some of that stuff. And when you look at all the people who've signed up for those programs, that money that we have will help 2-3% of those people on the waiting list, right? So now what do you do with the other 97% of the people? They've clearly raised their hand. They've clearly filled out some form and got themselves on some list, right? And if on one side you're willing to pay, you know, 13 cents a kilowatt hour for a new nuclear plant, and on this side, right, all the consultants have said, well, the benefit cost of helping poor people has to be 3 cents a kilowatt hour. That seems unequal, right? Like, it feels like if on this side you're willing to pay for 24/7 clean firm generation, and on this side you're saying energy efficiency is only worth 3 cents, that seems unequal, right? So you could imagine saying, hey, why don't we update the benefit tests so that we can say, hey, you know, like, you know, if they are reducing the strain on the grid by doing weatherization, by getting energy efficient appliances, by doing all these things, well, then we should at least be able to compensate them the same as we are all the other measures we're looking at, right? And then to your point, Amy, there's a further, you know, obligation that we have in terms of just dignity, right? Like, folks don't like being behind on their electricity bills. Folks don't like having that challenge. And so how do you set up rate tariffs and those kinds of things to be more dignified so that folks can, you know, use this service to live a modern lifestyle but not feel bad about it?
What do you think about what California's tried to experiment with, which you have sort of income-based tariffs for electricity?
Look, I mean, I generally don't love complexity. So, you know, I think that in general, complexity ends up making, you know, outcomes occur that you didn't predict, right? And so I think, like, you know, something a little simpler. And California did this back in 2001 or so, where they did the graduated, you know, sort of kilowatt hour rates, where the first 300 kilowatt hours were 9 cents, the next one were 12 cents. I think they got rid of that recently. But that, I think, made a lot more sense to me, because poor people generally use less kilowatt hours than someone with a 5,000 square foot house. But I think that there's a lot to do there, but I think it's important to note that what we really want to solve for here is, yes, energy burden, but more importantly, peak power, right? That our grid, all of the costs of our grid are related to increasing peak. So if we can help incentivize people to join a virtual power plant, right, to figure out how to reduce power consumption at peak, then they're saving everyone on the grid a huge amount of money.
So let's talk about virtual power plants a bit then, because I know that's something been a big interest for you. And there are some great numbers you've got in recent reports, actually some of them coming from us at Wood Mackenzie. So I'm clearly not going to disagree. I'm not going to disagree with those numbers.
They're
obviously extremely reliable. I think it's something like 30 to 60 gigawatts of VPP capacity in the US today, and a goal of, and let me even just look that up right now. Here we go, 80 gigawatts to 160 gigawatts available by 2030. So, I mean, as you say, relative to what is total power generation capacity of the US, whatever that is, about 1.2 terawatts, about 1,200 gigawatts. That's certainly a very significant amount of capacity. I have to say, when I talk to people in the industry, I get quite a lot of pushback against those numbers. And people will say, yeah.
Oh, 100%.
I'm sure you get it too, right? And people will say, this is greatly exaggerated. You know, there's no way it adds up to that amount.
My point is that this is not, I am not asking for people to bet on thermostats, right? I get the fact that thermostats have their issues and people are like, well, when it's 110 degrees outside, people don't want to be flexible. I get all that, right? But for 30 years, the rural electric co-ops in this country have been, you know, changing the way in which your electric water heater runs. And says, instead of turning it on right after you finish a shower, how about we turn it on in the middle of the day? You don't really care as long as it's hot the next morning. But for whatever reason, this is a radical idea that no one has ever thought of in the history of time, right? I don't know what's going on. And on top of that, every new water heater that comes out now has an app on the phone. So I can turn off my water heater right now while we're recording this podcast. Right? So if I can do that now, connectivity is clearly not an issue. So now what I need is to take that connectivity and tie it to some market signal, right? So that when there's spilled solar and wind power because we have curtailment, well, that's when I turn on my water heater, which happens to be when wholesale market prices are negative.
Well, and you know, Vermont, you know, has this policy. I mean, they did a rate case and they showed that if they just basically leased everybody in the state, or not everybody, but a lot of different retail customers, this home battery, that the state would be better off than adding capacity.
It's even worse than that, Amy, right? Because we are investing in huge Tesla megapacks and other stuff at distribution substations. One in seven households in this country have decided that they need backup power. One in seven, right?
Wow.
So they have gone to Home Depot.
Right,
and they've
incredible number.
$2,400 generator, which is totally unsafe, that they just have in their garage.
Right.
And when they lose power, they turn it on and then they just plug stuff in, right? Some people actually go with like Generac or something like that and actually put in something that's whole home. That's like, I think, 6% of American households. And then 4% of American households do like solar with battery backup, right? So like, so the American people have spoken. They want backup power. So instead of putting a mega pack in the middle of nowhere, why not just say, look, for $10 a month, I'll put this in your garage.
Right. So I have so many thoughts about this. There's two crucial things I want to get to. Firstly, just on this point about what we're really talking about then when we talk about VPPs. As you say, you talked about some of these changes in terms of appliances, home water heating and things like that that can be adjusted essentially without the consumer ever knowing the difference. And my question, I guess, is how much flexibility really is available that way, as opposed to the other thing we've just been talking about, which is home energy storage. And you know, that I can see. If everyone's got a battery pack in their home, that's huge.
Hey, that it worked in Australia.
And it works in Australia. No, absolutely. And it works for the people that have got it now in the United States. But as I say, that seems to be a different thing. And in particular, then, to come on to the other crucial thing, I think, which is that upfront cost is significant, right? And as you say, particularly people on low incomes, they're not going to be going out. What is a Powerwall system start at? But I was seeing one advertised the other day, I think, for about $8,000. The upfront cost is very significant.
Well, it is. But I mean, there's 4,500 systems a month that are paying for it in Puerto Rico. So it's not like they're not happening every single month, right? And the battery attachment rate now in California is, you know, something like 70%. So folks are paying for it.
Oh, no, no. And also, Ed, people are talking about having your utility own the equipment.
No, indeed.
And they're going to put it in your house and then you're going to lease it from them.
Sure. You have on-bill financing.
Like cable TV.
No, I totally agree. There's lots of business models And, you know, some of them make the utilities and their shareholders money because they can rate base it. And some of the stuff is more of a bring your own device type structure. And you know, at the Department of Energy, our job is to explain it all to people with a uniform fact base. It's not to tell people what to do. So that's what we've done in the VPP liftoff report. But I think it's important for everyone to note that we're done piloting these technologies. Nobody needs to pilot them anymore. And it's only about $35 million to actually put in all the software layers to fully integrate this into a utility, right? That's already been done by rural co-ops. And now, you know, the IOUs have to do it, right? And the reason it matters is because it, at some point, this stuff becomes laughable, right? So in my neighborhood, in where I live in Bethesda, we're down to 18% capacity utilization of my distribution grid because they've sized it so that when everyone's heat pumps and everyone's EV chargers connect, it has to be able to handle it. That doesn't make any sense, right? At some point, you can't just keep increasing the transformer. You have to like schedule the loads, right? And pay people a discount on their bill to opt in. And as you suggested, Ed, I think we also need to make sure that people are protected. And so if at any time they want to give up the discount and they want to pay a premium for being able to turn things on whenever they want, they should be able to do that too and have an easy opt out, just like an unsubscribe in an email.
So question, how much of the root of these issues is really to do with the structure of utility regulation in the US? And how much to really get change and to get these kinds of technologies deployed at scale, do you need a completely different model? And Amy, you were just talking about rate basing and how important that is. But that model essentially where what utilities want is to make capital investments and they then earn a return on those investments. And that's how they grow their profits, which is sort of absolutely standard across the US. And actually in other countries around the world, they have somewhat different models and interesting variations and different ways to try it.
The UK has done a ton of this great work, like performance-based regulation. But even in Hawaii, for instance, the way that they're doing the batteries there now, as I understand it, is they basically pay a fixed payment, which is sort of like the amortization cost of the battery, to the battery owner so that they can cover debt service. And then every time they dispatch the battery, there's a performance bonus to the battery owner and a performance bonus to HEI for doing the dispatch, right? So for preferring that over turning on another diesel generator, right? And so they're getting paid a performance bonus for that, so shareholders enjoy, right? So I think there's lots of great ideas on how to do that. But I think fundamentally what we need to all recognize is that regulators have a responsibility in this moment in time to protect their ratepayers. And for a long time, the regulators have been basically saying, this is not a hostile work environment, right? The utilities get to propose what they want. We don't understand half of it, or we don't have enough staff to process it, and therefore we're just going to rubber stamp it. And I think at some point we have to say, no, like we can't just have rates go up by 10% a year every single year. At some point you have to force the utilities to deploy technologies we've been piloting for 30 years.
Well, and you know, the utilities, I mean, there's some politics involved and that's some polarization because like you're talking about these people who retired because they didn't want to learn something new. So if I know how to throw in a natural gas peaker and I know how to do that, like now you're asking me to go out like they did say in Vermont or Hawaii and figure out a rate base to put these things in people's homes I don't really know much about. And somebody's told me that, you know, the supply chain from China is insecure and yak, yak, yak. And it's too newfangled.
But the dirty little secret, Amy, is that it's not an option. The dirty little secret is that the natural gas power plant industry is sold out through 28. And so even if you wanted to build a bunch of natural gas power plants, they don't even have them. So unless you want to basically put a bunch of 400 kilowatt backup natural gas piston powered, you know, units, you know, everywhere, which is great. Like Enchanted Rock does that with, you know, Walmart and HEB and all these other folks, which is great. You know, like it's not even an option. So like it's I love the fact that people are like, well, but Jigar, it's this versus that. I'm like, no, we need to get nuclear, geothermal. We need to get grid modernization going. We need to get VPPs going. We need to learn again how to live in a growth environment. And for 20 years, we've been like playing hungry, hungry hippos with, you know, the same number of marbles. Well, the marbles are increasing now. So we need all these other technologies to, you know, scale up.
Isn't another crucial point about utility regulators, though, that they are risk averse for good reason, partly just because the grid is a complex system that everyone relies on, and it's absolutely right not to take risks with it. And also just because the incentives they face are very, very one-sided, right? So if you innovate and it's a success and you maybe save ratepayers some money, that's great.
I don't know. Like, have you been to the state of California recently, right? If you go to the state of California and you get into an Uber, every Uber driver in all of the state of California just talks your ear off the entire trip about how electricity rates are too high. You tell me that that's actually like one-sided, that like the regulators in California aren't feeling pressure for the fact that people are paying, you know, the second highest rates in the country. Like at some point, like it just becomes laughable. At some point, you like have to actually figure out how to regulate these utilities. You can't just say like, well, you know, that's what it costs to do all the things that people want to do, right? I mean, okay. But like at some point, like folks have to realize that we have a gargantuan number of technologies that we've piloted here at the Department of Energy for 45 years. And it's time. It is time to deploy them at scale. Maybe it wasn't time 3 years ago, although I would argue that it probably was. But whatever, it is time today. And now that we are in a growth environment, you can do it the right way, and that will reduce electricity rates because the denominator is going up and the numerator is controlled. Or you could do it the wrong way, and then you just keep having 10% rate increases every year.
You know, Jigar, when you're talking about it, you remind me of history. Because in California, there was a major storage area for natural gas caught at Aliso Canyon, and it had a leak. And, you know, there was all this question about whether or not, you know, they could still operate it, even though it was, you know, had these problems for the people who lived near the facility. And at the time, California made this very controversial decision, which they decided to fast track. Some of the companies that said they could go into LA Basin with solar and battery storage and reduce the need for using Aliso Canyon storage. And they were successful. They put in something like 30 or 40 megawatts of this combined solar batteries. It worked. You know, nobody had a blackout, and which, you know, the natural gas companies were threatening. And it proved out the technology kind of like on an emergency basis. And, you know, I think what you're saying is, you know, we don't need to wait for an emergency. Like we know what these technologies are.
Yeah. But also when a utility company goes to the regulator and says, we're going to have a 7% load growth, they are in fact calling for an emergency. Right. That is what that means. Right. Like, I just feel like people are just not reading the tea leaves. Like when somebody does an emergency integrated resource plan, which many of these utilities have, and they say we have a 7% rate increase, they are saying that we're in an emergency situation and we need advice from the regulator to help us like navigate this. I agree with you. I mean, we have mapped and remapped and mapped again the fact that we could build 200,000 megawatts of solar next week on rooftops across the country, many of which are 4 acres or above in size. So they're the same cost to install it on there as you install it on the ground, right? And they're on the distribution circuit, so you don't need to upgrade the T or the D, right? So they're right there. And then you can say, look, in order for safety, we want you to pair it with batteries so that you're not backfeeding the grid. Fine. I don't care what your rule set is. Just do it already, right? It's not like Prologis and all these other like warehouse owners haven't already done 500 megawatts of solar. They know how to do it safely. They know what their rules are. And it could be the case that like the only way to do this fast is for the utilities to rate base it. At this point, I don't care, right? Like, I mean, if the utilities want to rate base it and that's how they want to do the right thing, great. If they want to like figure out a way to create the right incentives for the private sector to do it, fantastic, right? But at this moment in time, what we should not be doing is the most expensive approach possible, which is new natural gas with upgraded transmission and upgraded distribution. That is something we should not like strive to do. The most expensive solution possible is what we should do. No, please don't do that.
So as I hear you talk, it occurs to me that we're not really talking about technology anymore. We're talking about anthropology and sociology and psychology.
100%. This is culture and norms. 100%.
Well, isn't that the real problem then? That actually the hardest things, when you can change technology all you like, it's culture and norms that are really difficult things to shift.
Yeah, but that's true for this entire administration, right? Whether it's like, I mean, the workforce, right? We have for 40 years told people, you must send your children to college. They must have a huge, you know, college debt burden, when today we're 500,000 people short on the trades. And you can make a six-figure salary with like 8 years of training. And so like there's a lot of ninth graders right now that are going into vocational school to go work in some of the factories that we have under construction. It's awesome to see parents starting to change their culture and norms and saying, you know what, I think it would be fine for my child to decide to be somebody who wants to become a skilled tradesperson as opposed to going to college, right? And so like we're changing culture and norms across this country in terms of permitting, in terms of figuring out how we like don't end up in these like cycles of 17 different lawsuit cycles when we don't need to. Like we all need to come together. We need to figure out how to do the hard things. Not everyone's going to be happy, clearly. But like, you know, we try to make in an open process where it's transparent, where everyone knows what's happening, and then we make the best decision we can, right? Whether it's a new transmission line corridor or whether it's, you know, like critical minerals mining in, you know, Nevada or other places, right? We have to start doing big things in this country again.
Yeah, no question. And then I'll tell you, Jigar, here at NYU, we're developing a program for young people like you're describing. We call it Earn and Learn. So, you know, one of the things we know from the Pell Grant program and other great scholarship programs is that students, even if they have the financial aid to cover the costs of going to college, they need to earn money to help their families.
Yeah.
And so we need to come up with, and we are working on a structure where you can work for a company, and maybe you have a young person that doesn't want to take a vocational position. Maybe they'd like to be, you know, a person at Google or work for Jigar Shah, right? And so, you know, our program would take you and have that employer pay you while you're doing that job. We're going to give you college credit for what you're learning while you're doing that job, and then we'll supplement that with educational opportunities for your BA or BS at NYU that could be taken in a more flexible way so that you could have this full-time job where you have a full-time salary and you're in an organization that's where you want to work.
No, I think that's right. And the same thing's true with the hyperscale data center owners, right? They've made these big pronouncements around the fact that they would be 100% clean energy and 24/7 clean firm matched. And it used to be that they could just, you know, save money by signing these contract for differences contracts with solar and wind farms, which are deeply in the money now, and they're making billions of dollars of savings with that. But now they've got to sign above market prices for advanced geothermal or nuclear or other things in order to meet their requirements. And it's a huge cultural change for them where their CFO is saying, look, this isn't the noise. I don't care. Just get it done. We need access to power. And their negotiators on the ground are saying, we're going to be tough as nails and we're going to slow this process down for 2 years because we want to negotiate the best deal, when in fact, they actually need access to power. That's what they need. They don't like. And so everyone is like changing norms and culture up and down the chain.
So let's talk about those two technologies then, advanced geothermal and nuclear, because I think they're both really interesting. And as you say, that question of clean, firm power is becoming particularly critical. And as we've been saying, there's an enormous amount you can do by addressing peaks in demand and making better use of existing infrastructure and so on. But there is also going to need to be new generation capacity added to the grid of various kinds and also off the grid as well. Talk about enhanced geothermal. A lot of buzz about that at the moment. There seems to be a lot of people want to talk to me about it. How confident are you that that is going to turn into a viable industry?
Well, the great thing is it doesn't matter how confident I am. What matters is how confident the oil and gas sector is. And they are over the moon confident about this. Like I just talked to the top three drilling companies in the country, and they have never in their history ever warranted their work. They just don't do it. What they do is they say, pay me, we'll do a good job. And if you need damages, the damages are capped at the cost of the drilling, right? So we're not going to fix whatever mess we made. And they're saying, this is so easy for us that maybe in the first time in our history, we'll warranty our work because that's how easy this drilling is. Like, this is child's play compared to what we do all the time, right? And this is them saying that, right? And so they're...
So, but what about the you know, longevity of the conversion of the heat to, you know, usable electricity? Is it going to be baseload and you can't adjust it? Is it going to kind of be like nuclear where we can't really have it go up and down? It's not really going to be more like hydro. Like how is it going to practice?
Yeah. So let me start from the beginning for a second. So traditional geothermal basically is you have to find hot rock and you have to find a working fluid, liquid water that's there, right? And then you have to find that sort of specific situation. You have to drill it and you have to like precisely hit it. With enhanced geothermal, you make your own pockets and then you put the fluid into those pockets, right? And so as a result, every place in the entire country can do this. Now, there are 6 states in the West that are cost effective today. And then as the technology gets cheaper and cheaper, it'll be cost effective to do it in other states around the country. When you have this type of system, by definition, there is built-in storage within the fluid, right? And so this can produce power 24/7, but if for whatever reason the wholesale market prices are negative, you can say, you know what, it's not worth actually running this mechanical equipment right now. We're going to pause it. We're going to let more pressure, build up in the pipes, and then we're going to turn it back on in 8 hours. Now, it's not designed to be turned down for 4 days. It's designed maybe for 8 hours, but that's pretty damn valuable. Right. And so as opposed to a nuclear plant, which likes to be run 24/7.
Yeah. 4 hours could be valuable. Yeah.
Yeah. And then nuclear plants can do the same thing, to be clear. They can be turned up and down, but you just sort of lose that power. And so it becomes more expensive. So they like to run 24/7, 365. Right. Whereas geothermal, you don't lose that pressure. The pressure just backs up and then you basically, use it later. Right. So geothermal has that benefit, but it needs to cross that bridge to bankability. So these first projects are above $100 a megawatt hour to produce it. And we need to do about 2,000 to 5,000 megawatts of geothermal to get it across that bridge to bankability. And then we think that if you do that, you'll get to $70 a megawatt hour by 2030 and $45 a megawatt hour by 2035, which is a game changer. This is only in those 6 states in the West, and then the timelines vary for other states.
But that's a pretty long timeline, Jigar, to be frank. I mean, you're talking about a long time before this technology is going to be commercial, and those numbers still sound a little high.
Well, I mean,
Bloomberg saying that, wind and solar is going to get to $20 by 2030.
But that's only the first part of wind and solar. Right. When you make it clean firm, then you have to have 18 hours of battery storage to it. And that 18 hours of battery storage makes it over $150 a megawatt hour. So they're all different. It's different choices. And DOE doesn't have a preference. We really don't. Like, I mean, our job is to say if you built a new AP1000 today with the new IRA money and the exact same cost structure as Unit 4 at Vogtle, it would be $92 a megawatt hour. So if that's valuable to you, there you go. If you do geothermal, we think that you can get down the cost curve. Fantastic. Offshore wind, we have a similar, liftoff report that we just came out with. Long duration energy storage, right, which is another way to do clean firm power, right? They're all options, and every one of them has a cost, and every one of them has a cost curve, right?
Let's talk about, company, project for SMR, so small nuclear reactors, the Utah project. But bit the dust because they thought they might get somewhere between $87 or $120 per megawatt hour. And that was like too costly to green light.
And NuScale is still a great technology and they've got a lot of other prospects. I think that two things. One is that, look, they were overly optimistic. The very first reactor is going to cost $150 to $200 a megawatt hour. It just is. Right. And so let's not like play games in the same way that the very first utility scale solar projects were 36 cents a kilowatt hour and then 17 cents a kilowatt hour in California. And then now Texas is doing it for cheap. Fine. Right. But if you built enough, so if you built 7 or 8 gigawatts of nuclear of the same exact design, on average across that entire fleet, it'll be roughly $90 a megawatt hour. Right. And so that's what you're signing up to. You pay $200 a megawatt hour for the first 300 megawatts. And then the second one's cheaper. The third one's cheaper. The fourth one's cheaper. And you just go down the cost curve. Right. And you've seen that happen in other countries. And so it's not like this is not foreseeable. Folks have to sign up to it. Right. And so that's what it is. And in NuScale's case, in UAMPS, right, you're talking about a very small collection of municipal utilities. So they really didn't have the depth of energy consumption to be able to do it all, right? Whereas Georgia Power is much larger, and even they shared with MEAG and Jacksonville Electric Authority for those two, you know, nuclear reactors in Georgia.
And I guess presumably some of those data center operators that have, as you say, clean energy goals, emissions reduction goals, want 24/7 power, they're going to be ideal customers, aren't they, for nuclear? And we've seen a little bit of that already, right? We've seen some deals being done.
Yeah, I mean, well, you saw that Amazon, you know, paid a premium for power from Talon, right, with their co-location there. I think you're seeing a big deal was announced recently between Microsoft and Brookfield to provide, you know, 24/7 power. And so, but also Microsoft, I think, signed a contract with somebody in the Northwest and paid a premium for 24/7 power from Hydro, which was a lot more expensive than what they were paying before because they wanted the 24/7 matching. Iron Mountain signed a contract with Rye Development up in Pittsburgh, and that was at $115 a megawatt hour. So, like, in general, when you think about what the competition is, right now, all clean firm power sources, even natural gas plus carbon sequestration and storage, right? All of that is coming in at roughly that $100 megawatt hour range, right? Now, we think that some of the cost curves will come down faster because they're manufactured products that can get cheaper and cheaper. And some of them won't really come down and cost that much. Like nuclear power is never going to get to $10 a megawatt hour. It's not a manufactured unit, right? It just isn't, right? So that's what it is. But it's also the single largest source of clean energy in the world today, still in the United States and other places, right? And so when you think about the modeling work that we've done with the National Renewable Energy Laboratory's Clean Futures model or Jesse Jenkins model at Princeton, having more clean firm resources reduces the amount of new transmission you have to build. And transmission seems to be the only thing that's harder to build in this country than nuclear. And so, you know, so it's one of those things where we all have trade-offs and we all have to work through those trade-offs to get to the president's goals of 2035 and 2050.
So let me ask you a follow-up question on the SMR question, because everything you're saying is just fabulously interesting, accurate, and really the way people should be thinking about it. What's going on with, you know, Centrus had this delay because of the cylinder shortages. So just explain to the listeners again that some of these SMRs require the HALO fuel, which is the high assay, low enriched uranium.
Yeah.
Where are we on that?
Well, so in general, it was fairly easy to get HALEU fuel from Russia in the past, right? So this was not a huge priority for us. Obviously, after the Ukraine conflict, it has become a much larger priority for us. And, you know, basically, low enrichment uraniums are in the single-digit percentage concentrations. And, you know, HALEU fuel is sort of in the low double digits concentrations, right? And there's variable fuel types and, you know, different people have proprietary mixes and all that stuff. But that's really what we're talking about here. And, you know, one of the big challenges that we have is for Centrus or some of these other companies, they want customers, right? And the customers are saying, well, we need to get through the Advanced Reactor Deployment Program and build our first reactor before we can sell 10 more, right? And so we only want to buy so much, right? And so there's this sort of chicken and egg. I think once you have a very strong demand signal from people to buy the HALEU fuel, I think you've got several folks who can ramp up their capacity to make it very quickly. And so right now we're in this chicken and egg situation. And so Congress has allocated money for us to, you know, provide grants and other types of support to help kickstart this industry. But we know how to make the fuel. That's not the issue. It's really just, you know, like how do we set up the infrastructure to build it before you've got firm folks who want to buy it.
So I see, unfortunately, we're just about out of time. I think we're going to have to leave it in a moment. Before we let you go, and it's been fantastic talking to you, Jigar, and thanks very much for being generous with your time today. Just wanted to ask, final thought, going back to where we came in, about your work at the LPO and what you've been doing. When you eventually come to leave and you go back to podcasting or whatever it might be in the private sector, what is success going to look like? What will you want to look back on and say, this is what we've really achieved. This is what we've changed in U.S. energy.
So in 2008, 9, and 10, I was very active in a lot of these conversations with my peers in the clean tech CEO space. And the message was very clear. If you have created a great technology and you've now gone through a C round or a D round, you should start flying to China or Europe and figuring out where to commercialize your technology, right? No one thought that this is the place that we should do it, that we shouldn't tie it to the American worker and all that stuff. I think after this tour of duty, if we can get people to believe that the U.S. is the best place to do it, that they don't have to go around the world to do this, that they can do it here, they can tie it to the American worker, that we can use technology and all the technology breakthroughs that we keep creating to be competitive here, right? That would be an enormous accomplishment. For whatever reason, I think we have just decided that America can't do big things, and I think we have to change that perception.
No, I couldn't agree more that this is really the power of what the Inflation Reduction Act has done. And, you know, let's hope we get there. We're just very lucky.
I think we're there. You know, we have 500.
Time man of the year, you know. we're just really lucky that we have you at the helm.
Well, I'm just so lucky that we were able to pass this bold policy agenda under the president's leadership, and obviously the secretary has made massive changes to the Department of Energy. And I think the ability for us to really, truly make real this public-private partnership has never been stronger. I just think DOE has never been more relevant to the clean tech sector, and as well as the traditional oil and gas industry and others who are trying to make hay in this moment. And so it's an incredibly optimistic time, I think.
Utility listeners, I want you to go back and listen to this show more than once and understand what needs to be done on the commercial rate base to get this across this finish line.
This was so much fun. I think we accomplished what we came here to do. Respectful but spicy.
Wonderful.
Thanks to our producers, Toby Biggins-Gilchrist and Sam Nash. And above all, many thanks to all of you for listening. As you know, we really value your feedback, so please do keep it coming. And we'll be back in 2 weeks with all the latest news and views on the energy transition. Until then, goodbye.